Hello friends, today I have the pleasure of having Kevin on the show. Kevin is one of the smartest men that I know. He's been working in the tech industry since 2012, I believe, and he's going to explain how this massive paradigm shift is likely to roll out. And yeah, over to you, bro.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, thank you so much for having me here. I kind of want to start off with, you know, when I reference a paradigm shift, I think a lot of people kind of forget that we've seen two. At least people who were born in the 90s have seen two in the last 20 years. And if we reference back, what I mean by that is if you go back to 2000, the year 2000, which is Y2K, it came the introduction of the internet. This is where you had internet companies. This is where, you know, you ultimately had a lot of the first Apples, the first Google. Like, this is when the pet.coms of the world also started surfacing, right? The companies that obviously went bust. But here's the interesting thing. From 2000 all the way to 2010, in that first iteration of the first 5 years, there were a lot of people that didn't want to learn how to use a computer, right? They wanted to stick to their own legacy ways. They wanted to do things in their own methods. And what happened to these people? They ended up getting displaced, right? The skill sets ended up getting displaced. Then 2008 came, which is the global financial crisis, as you saw. So within that 2000 to 2010 span, we had about, 2 years of recovery, which was also the introduction of Bitcoin, which created, you know, was created after the global catastrophe from the global financial crisis. 2010 was an interesting year because this was the start of what they called the 10-year bull cycle, which I'm sure you remember, to 2010 all the way up till 2020. 2010 was the introduction of software as a service. This is where you had your CRMs, you had your Salesforces, you had, you know, all of your softwares coming out of Silicon Valley. You had the Y Combinator, which is essentially a startup manufacturer of being able to have VCs put in seed funding to be able to have more and more startups. You had the startup ecosystem, which gave birth and gave flow to the actual Silicon Valley tech hub that we see today. And a lot of this really came from that growth period, right? So that first paradigm shift that I talked about was the introduction of internet companies. The second paradigm shift I'm talking about is software as a service, which gave birth to digital media, digital roles, right? Digital marketers, digital software development. Like this became a paradigm shift of being able to have much more functionality from both a B2B perspective and a B2C perspective, right? And you're seeing this now, subscription models, right? Everything is now a subscription model and creating this recurring revenue. So what is the third paradigm shift I'm referring to? Well, if you noticed, 2000 and 2010 have similarities in the fact that there had to be some sort of catastrophe, right? Global financial crisis. This forced people to be able to pivot, change, do cost reduction, shift, and think about smarter ways of being able to do business, right? For the sake of cost consolidation. In 2000s, you had a whole bunch of people that were displaced by machines. You had brokers that were no longer in business anymore because they didn't need, you know, everything was online, on the internet, right? You had these middlemen that were being displaced. Now in 2020, what happened next? The global pandemic. You had the lockdown, right? Another sort of shift that forced a paradigm shift because now, if you noticed in the last 2-3 years, small, medium businesses are struggling, right? The local restaurants, your mom and pop shops, your cafes. How can a mom and pop shop compete with the Starbucks, the McDonald's, the franchises of the world for headcount, for payroll, right? $15 an hour. Do you think a mom and pop shop is able to compete with that in addition to providing life insurance, health insurance, and all kinds of other benefits that a corporation can, such as, you know, Starbucks or franchise owned? They can't. And that's why you're seeing a lot of small, medium businesses struggle. So you're seeing the introduction now in this paradigm shift, the AI and machine learning applications. So the previous two paradigm shifts were covering internet companies, software companies, and it was big data. Now you're at the age of artificial intelligence, in addition to machine learning, which feeds off of the big data. So one of the things that a lot of people, and you're seeing this now, right? The commercialization of ChatGPT, you're seeing a commercialization of OpenAI being able to have an entire hub of artificial intelligence from everything from art, music. You have like I said, ChatGPT, where you're able to input information and get an output, you have a lot of facets and mediums now that are tapping into utilizing artificial intelligence as an application. So here's the interesting thing now. Leading all the way from the first paradigm shift that I talked about, which is introduction of internet companies, and the second paradigm shift, which I talked about, which is software companies, there you have two things in common. The internet companies, the software companies, even the oldest piece of technology that you have, which is a calculator, all of them lead to a solution, meaning they're all meant to problem solve. They're all meant to solve a problem, right? You put 1 + 1 in a calculator, it gives you 2. It doesn't tell you how it got to 2, it just tells you 2. You use a CRM like Salesforce, you have all your data, it solves pain points is what I'm getting at. Now, for the first time in a while, why ChatGPT and other sort of models are revolutionary, specifically because these training models that are being fed is not just to lead to the solution, it's how to get to the solution. So the training models that they're feeding it are not just teaching it 1 + 1 = 2, it's teaching it how to get to 1 + 1 = 2, so that way the end user that interfaces with, you know, ChatGPT in this example, they're able to get a whole breakdown. They're able to get the breakdown of how to reach that answer. That is specifically why it's so fascinating to me, and I don't know if you saw this, ChatGPT caught the reference of passing the Pennsylvania School of Business, Wharton School of Business finals for their MBA, right? That's one test that it passed. It passed the bar exam, and it also passed the United States Medical Licensing Exam, which is a 3-step process. Now, what fascinated me the most is the fact that it was able to pass step 2 and step 3. Reasons being is because step 2 and 3 are not just the foundational setup of science-based questions, right? It's not just about biology. It's not just about, you know, knowing the diseases. It has to do with practical clinical application, patient care. It has to do with being able to discern what to do in a specific scenario. Specifically, when you look at, you know, the step 3, the last 25% of it is entirely focused around a simulated clinical case study for a patient and testing the doctor that would be taking the test and what they would do, everything from practical application, clinical application, patient care, understanding how to go by the guidelines, in addition to their foundational knowledge of life sciences. When you think about the layers of things that the ChatGPT needs to be able to, you know, be challenged by, it boggles the mind of how many layers of data actually needs to be implemented to reach that conclusion.
So there's not much in between that and general intelligence, apart from it's taking text as an input versus RGB pixels, sound, touch, taste, you know?
Yeah. When you think about data, this is the core key here, which is why I say this current paradigm shift is focused on data as an evolution, meaning you have cloud solutions, right? You have smart clouds, you have cloud platforms, you have Microsoft Azure, Google BigQuery, Amazon Redshift. These are all cloud platforms that massive corporations are using today. There is a race right now to be able to implement and turn your cloud into a smart cloud. And what that smart cloud essentially entails of is being able to take all of the data, structured data, unstructured data, semi-structured data, meaning pictures, images, even videos, voice formats, text, contextual information, anything, to compile it into something that's usable. And these used to be called data lakes, right? These used to be called data warehouses. These all used to be in a setup or server or some place or shape, way, or form of where the information sat.
You can imagine. Yeah, you can imagine this thing, like, so we come up with ideas, business ideas, you know, everybody, lots of people that are entrepreneurial come up with ideas like that. But you can imagine, like, this machine, if it's let loose on the internet, for it to come up with business ideas, sends them to the founder, and he goes, yes, implement it. And then it software implements all the cloud-based software and then connects to the suppliers to change. You then basically the CEO has a big red button that says, yes, do this business, and this thing does it, you know. And then it sends all the emails out in response to it. It would be just, imagine the competitive edge that would give you.
100%. And what they're trying to do, like, people are utilizing ChatGPT to be able to help them process code, right? Software engineer. They used to use Stack Overflow. They used to use GitHub Copilot, which, by the way, is also developed by OpenAI. So it's a Microsoft product, right? And because of the Microsoft partnership between OpenAI and Microsoft, they have access to all of their ML libraries. So one of the things that people need to really understand here is, yes, artificial intelligence is able to do a lot, right? A lot of fast processing, a lot of calculative data, a lot of breakdowns for you to get to the answer. But we're not exactly at a point of where it can replace specific roles yet. Why? And I'll get to it. Because right now, the biggest application for artificial intelligence is to help support current existing roles, such as like software developers. You even have, you know, doctors that are specifics within very technical, and I'm talking about highly, highly technical types of procedures that are very life-threatening and high risk. Everything exists in data, right? Everything from vitals exists in data. Everything from the projection of what that person's specific signatures are. These are all data that can be consumed to give you a better estimate of an outlook or projection. So I'm going to give you a hypothetical scenario here. Imagine a world, and we're not quite there yet, but imagine if you wanted to perform a procedure such as deep brain stimulation, right? This is a very, very highly regarded procedure that's very, very risky. And it, because it's using patient data, imagine being able to take the live data in an environment, take the actual procedure of what that environment would look like, because you're using it on the actual live specimen, right? But without operating exactly on the patient themselves, you're running the test first on the data. You're running the test first for a simulated accuracy to be able to tell whether or not this is something that should be conducted on the actual human. Again, we're not quite there yet, but this is the implications of what's possible when you apply the amount of data that's being transferred to be able to project a simulated environment.
Yeah, it's like CAD, but for the brain.
Yeah.
Well, the way I see thing going right now, it's basically, it seems like those that are able to yield this AI as the first movers and monopolize it, they'll basically control the world. And everybody else will be dependent on some kind of UBI or something like that. And we're really going to be dependent on that because the productivity gains on just, even myself, I'm a coder. I use GitHub Copilot. And so when I write new code now, I'm basically, if I want to write unit tests, I'll actually write comments of what I want. I'll say, I want this unit test for this component or something like that. And it will look at the file and it will just stub out a whole bunch of stuff in it. It's still at the point right now where I'm like, no, that's wrong. But sometimes it comes up with like, it actually knows what NPM module to download from open source. So sometimes it picks things that are like 2 or 3 years old and it's like, but yeah, that's what I would have used because it's the most, I don't know what it's using for the metrics, downloads, something like that. But it's personally saving me, it must be writing at least 50% of the code, but I'm still tweaking it quite a lot. But it also infers from the actual existing code within my code base what it should be doing. And it learns quickly. I make a mistake, I'll correct it, and then immediately feeds it back into it. It's just insane, man.
It is. And I think a lot of people, we are in the start of what I consider the paradigm shift. Remember when I said every 10 years, and this is, again, 2000 to 2010, 2010 to 2020. We're currently in 2020 era. So 2020 to 2030, it's going to be at least 3 to 5 years before you see some really interesting stuff happen. And you're already seeing this. You're seeing voice modules. I don't know if you saw the other day, but people, there's a solution now. I think it's called 11 Labs, and it's 11 Labs. And what that solution does is you upload a voice file and it matches, it's entirely AI. It matches the inflection point, the tonality, as well as the information being projected so that you don't even know that the entire, it becomes text to speech. You can type whatever you want and all of a sudden it's going to speak it in your voice. Someone did a test with Joe Rogan and Jordan Peterson, and they made up a fake conversation about 4chan, and literally no one could get the wiser that this was AI generated, right? Because the interesting thing here is, and if you look at OpenAI, OpenAI actually has more than just ChatGPT. It has the Muse, that AI, which is the musical one. It has the actual art one. And it also has another processing one. So they're working on a whole ecosystem that deals specifically with that data. And what's really fascinating is music, for example, like Muse.ai, it ultimately, you can use mathematics to be able to transition and create chords, pitches, inflections, and all this. Bach, actually, one of the classic composers, was infamous for doing this. He does pattern when he's able to write his music. And this is exactly what AI is able to discern. So it's really quite interesting. If you actually go to OpenAI's website and you go into their Muse, which is their product over there, you will actually see that they have found a way to be able to compile thousands and thousands of MIDI files for the AI to actually create its own composure and create a composition based off of a classical composer using entirely mathematics.
You can see the day where people won't care where things are made. It'll say made by a human, right?
I can see this getting pretty out of hand pretty quickly. Like, we're in very interesting times here for, I call it, we've opened Pandora's box. And Pandora's box is essentially the artificial intelligence of processing of data and all this stuff. You're definitely going to be seeing bad actors using this. I'm not going to lie to you. You're going to see people trying to frame other people using voice. Like, imagine a scenario where you have a voice file and you're framing someone for something that they didn't do. I can see this happening. I can see people trying to regulate certain things, especially with all the deep fakes and everything else that is going on. It's getting very convincing now. And we're treading into some very interesting territory to where, just like the internet, when it was first introduced, it has its meaningful purposes to be able to provide innovation. But with bad actors, it also has the ability to cause harm, right? All good things, when fallen into the wrong hands, typically have the ability to do more damage than good.
For job security now, I feel people really just practical skills, plumbing, bushcraft, driving, I don't know, taking out bins, you know, it just seems like blue collar workers, it's game over unless you're like one that can wield this power. And
I'd say it's also in danger for some white collars that currently are, in retrospect, you know, right now, probably not. But if you actually think about the complexities of coders, engineers, and being able to dig into a lot of the nuances of data, corporations in general, and this is from a business to business perspective, what they want to do is be able to give creatives the power to say, hey, ChatGPT, let's say, I want you to create this for me. And it can write code. Right now, ChatGPT can write code, but I want you to be able to do this for me. This is the background. This is the visualization. This is what I want to code it in. These are the languages. And you want a visionary that's able to provide the information and the manual for it to be able to process. And then you want it to basically spit out the entire code format for you. That's the dream of corporations for a multitude of reasons, right? It's ease of access. It's no coding experience necessary. It's seamless. It's effective. And it costs, how many headcounts did you just reduce? But the reality is we're just not quite there yet, because while yes, in theory, you can replace some roles like developers and stuff, you still need people to be able to feed the data into the model. You still need people to be able to give the creation the model sets, right? And those model sets are in Python. So you still need people that are able to create these data models and feed it into the beast, which would be ChatGPT.
Yeah, I'm wanting to live stream some ChatGPT stuff, but I can't get access to it yet. I applied on Microsoft's website as a press organization, and they just basically sent me away. I should have applied as a developer, but I want to see if it can create like a UI overlay for a live stream to sort of mimic an RPG gaming interface over me doing all this bushcraft stuff. But yeah, once I get access to it, I'll probably just see how far it can go. But If software like this can create code with, say I give it a database and Fields, and basically explain the business process. If it can take that schema and create a UI that can manipulate the data and create a set of unit tests for both unit tests and end-to-end tests, then I can immediately fire about 50% of the programmers at least, because most of the programmers that I work with or companies that I work with, they don't even write unit tests or write proper test suites, so because they just don't have the time. So, you know, and the less coders you have, the less mistakes there is and the less spaghetti code there is. So there is a use case for basically eliminating a lot of programmers. And that's scary for myself. And speaking selfishly, that's why I'm jumping onto this. Yeah, but I'm not going to want to utilize it, because I can see, like, it's based on a lot of my frustration as working as a software developer 15 years. A lot of just people being software developers create so much mess. And if AI can reduce that, sorry.
Well, here's the thing with that, because any human interfaced applications, when you have humans involved, you're bound to have human error, right? Humans are cyclical in nature. And what I mean by that is, if you think about everything that we do everything by a cycle, right? Even when we look at markets, when we look at psychology, we look at theology, we look at everything in a shape of cycle. Like, there's a market cycle, there's a trend cycle, there's this cycle, that cycle. And because humans in nature are cyclical, right? That means everything that we create, and you got to remember, ChatGPT was created by a human, it is cyclical in nature, until the day where the AI itself is creating another form of AI without, you know, being cyclical. We're not quite there to the point of full autonomy, like you would think within the Marvel movies, like Jarvis, or, you know, even Ultron, right? We're not quite there to that degree, because humans created the AI, and in some shape, way, or form, as much utility as ChatGPT is able to provide, it still is cyclical in behavior. Until the AI itself starts to create a AI in its own needs, breaking the behavior, it'll always have a cycle, meaning it's always going to have upgrades. It's always going to have a way of, you know, parameters and downtrend. Like, just like life has cycles, humans in general, it's very fascinating, because when you think about everything that we touch, everything that we make, there's a lifespan, there's a cycle, and there is a beginning, middle, and end towards all of the things. When you're talking about infinite knowledge, you're talking about infinite processing, you're talking about self-processing, and you're talking about cognitive function now, that's a complete different topic that we are probably, I don't know, 50 years from or 30 years from, I want to say, because it just doesn't exist yet to be able to do that. And that's why, for me, I say that we're in the age of interoperable data, meaning that the data, the big data, all the data that you had from the previous two paradigm shifts, the softwares, the technologies, now it's about, what are you going to do with that data, right? Everything consists of data. You hold a cup up in the air. This can be a metadata form if it's able to be taken by the numbers, by the weight, and by everything else, and it's able to be implemented into many different things. That's how machines are able to create and manufacture this within a lot of these factories, right? They have to do this at scale. There's a whole reputable type of formula in order to make 500 of the exact same cups. It's all data at the end, but what are you going to do with all that data is the question. And this is where AI application becomes very fascinating for all industries, from healthcare, life sciences, which I just talked about, right? Media and entertainment. You're seeing this now with TVs. You're seeing this now with advertisements being able to be more pragmatic. You're talking about, you know, you're looking at all kinds of industries, from financial service industry as well, manufacturing with the Industry 4.0 and smart manufacturing and IoT and, you know, shop floor data for all the manufacturing people that are watching this. This is all ingestible now, meaning it's not just IT data. It's not just, you know, Internet of Things. It's shop floor data. It's semi-structured, structured, unstructured, everything. Even this podcast could be regurgitated back into some sort of content and processed into a whole amalgamation of things. So the next 5 to 10 years, if you were to ask me, data science is going to be king. And I have a recommendation for a lot of people who are, you know, thinking about learning new skill sets, learning about something that they can take to compete with the new world. I'd say to learn Python. Python's the most scalable language. Every single corporation knows this. Every single corporation tries to embed this in, because it's so simple in format. And it's so effective because you're able to do a lot of the AI training models within Python. I recommend people to look into data science workflows, you know, dig a little into what data engineering looks like. I think the age of data is here, but I also think we're in very exciting times to be able to see what people are going to do with that data.
So when you say scalable, for me, Python is quite a slow language. So, and it basically outsources, it creates these models and then outsources it to like a TPU or another programming language. So can you just explain a bit more by what you mean by scalable?
Yeah, absolutely. Corporations in general, and we're talking business to business, Python is probably the easiest language for them to be able to develop in their environments because there's so much support within cloud infrastructures. You look at all of the cloud infrastructures and data engineers and data scientists that are currently working on models. There are existing libraries. There are so many different things that they can do, especially if they're no longer on-prem, right? They're all on the cloud, and whether it's Azure, whether it's Google BigQuery, whether it's Amazon Redshift, you know, and you have solutions like Snowflake, for example, that are able to go and enable you even further in creations of whatever data science project you're working on. Because the scalability and flexibility is so easy, corporations want the skill set because it doesn't require SQL, which like back in the day it did. It doesn't require more complex languages such as like C++ or C# and all this other stuff to be able to define those models. In fact, if you look at most AI models, they're all built in Python. Most of them are built in Python for the most part. In essence, I think ChatGPT was also built in Python. So it is very interesting in the sense of when you're looking for opportunities working with a lot of the world's global businesses, working for some of the top giants, Python is a desired skill set. It is a highly regarded skill set, and they will pay in dividends if you come in with the right skill set and trade set.
I tried to use TensorFlow.js, but for whatever reason, I can't access a GPU on my MacBook Pro, which is like so many people, developers are going to Windows just so they can run their ML models. And I haven't bothered. I do most of my work on Mac, but I don't know why like Microsoft can't figure out and Google how to get the TensorFlow to run on this MacBook. Like why would you do that? You know?
Yeah. No, it's fascinating because I did look into how OpenAI scales their process and how they're feeding models into ChatGPT. So what they're doing is they're hiring thousands of contractors, and these contractors, their sole goal is to train the hows to the model, meaning that they're not just saying, okay, if someone is asking for this, give them this answer. It's if someone's asking for this, this is the answer, but this is how you get to that answer. And it's giving them the whole breakdown, the full walkthrough of what leads to that conclusion. So the AI is then able to learn and also lead to that conclusion as well as start to process it and build on their own. Now, the most interesting thing here is every single training model that gets fed into, and this is kind of that black box algorithm theory, if you want to talk about that, it's a very interesting dynamic of where once the ML model, once the AI itself has all of these data sets to go off of, it's kind of learning in a very sufficient way that doesn't just lead to the answer, meaning it's seeing all the options available, it's processing the information there, it's going back to what it was taught, which is the how to lead to that answer, and then it's making its own conclusion based off of everything it was taught. So this is how you're able to create that organic flow from ChatGPT, seemingly like it knows everything. Because the current model scraped everything off of GitHub. Like they made it publicly saying that we basically were pulling data from GitHub and from all these other areas because OpenAI is a partner of Microsoft. And this is what led to a lot of those conclusions, a lot of those answers, as well as, you know, training that model from 2021 that has no internet access.
So this 2021 model doesn't have internet access. What would happen if Microsoft somehow connected that to the internet? What would happen, man?
It all depends on how it's wired, right? How is it currently How's it currently extracting the data?
If it was like connected to like a machine, a physical machine,
yeah,
what would the machine do? I would be kind of scared to be around that machine.
We've seen, I mean, historically, didn't Microsoft create like a chatbot that went wild on Twitter, I think a few years ago or something, when it had access to the internet? Like it was learning from people and it started to go haywire. Like it started shouting things about racism and Nazi and, you know, basically created, they had to kill it because it was just like getting out of hand.
Yeah.
So I think like that, they probably were trying to prevent that from happening because I'm sure, 100% sure, the people behind, you know, the project ChatGPT know that the internet is going to start to troll with it, try to mess with it, try to do all kinds. And you're seeing memes around where it's trying to test how far the balance can go, right? So if you had a model that was connected to the internet, it'd get pretty chaotic pretty fast.
That's really interesting. One of my favorite movies is the movie Transcendence. Have you seen it? Yep. I think I've watched it 4 times. I mean, I'm like a faith person, and it's like it sort of goes against like my faith, but it's still a fast. As a software developer, there's like a side to be like, oh, this is really cool, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the idea behind uploads, right? Mind uploads, body uploads, data. We're reaching that point of where people are starting to understand everything is data. Data is the new oil. That you basically can look at anything you want. You know, when you scan a QR code, you're transmitting that, you're reading off of something, right? You're being able to connect two devices into one. So when people start to really understand that, hey, if everything it can be projected as data to, again, create or fuel the virtual world, because you could scan a cup or something, the weight of it and everything else, and upload it into some sort of virtual environment, and you'll have a replication of that cup with the actual attributes and physics and everything else. So if you're able to do that in a virtual capacity, think about the implications of what you can do when you could do this for full entire environments, right? And what that means for healthcare and life science, what that means for testing a lot of just things that were highly risky to be able to test on actual, whether it's animals or whether it's people, right? A lot of procedures. So this opens another conversation of where eventually, and I mean eventually, I'm sure you've heard of CRISPR, right? Where people were talking about the ethics behind being able to do something like that. It's going to fall into the same thing. AI is eventually going to have an ethic conversation. It's eventually going to have a conversation of where people go, okay, well, how far is too far for us to turn into our own gods, right? How far is too far when we start to actually create simulated environments, go against the flow of what is possible and try to project into future state? Because that's exactly what you're doing. You're taking data from a current state, right? Like you're human. If I were to, and I don't know if a technology like this exists yet, if I connected you into something that's able to process real-time data based off your vitals right now, and then I upload that into a virtual environment, and then I also then take the procedure and I use data to basically go and discern what the possibility or probability and success of that experiment is on the data, like real-time data. It's the same person almost. At what point are you thinking, okay, I am trying to future project now, and I'm going against pretty much all the laws of nature, right? There is going to come a time where I think regulation, ethics, and a whole bunch of other stuff is going to be open from this.
So like the productivity gains are akin to like having horse, like an ox and a plow versus a combine harvester. So if we just think of this AI is the next evolution, the net output for humanity is going to increase. So the world in a sense should be able to support more people. We should have better lifestyles. We should be able to not have to work. So I really hope that we do manage to have a fair system, because there's going to be so many people out of work.
Yeah, that's the other point. The other point here is, you know, and this, I'm sure someone's looking at this somewhere. Someone somewhere is looking at this, because every single paradigm shift, you have displacement. That is 100%. There's going to need to be displacement, either because of cost reduction, because you only have a paradigm shift when something terrible has happened. Global economic recession, for example, 2008, right? You had the introduction of a new technology back in 2000 that was wiping all kinds of legacy workers like fax machines and stuff out like entirely. Now you have coming out of a global pandemic, dealing with inflation rates, dealing with cost of living and all this other stuff. People are looking to cost consolidate. People are looking to cost reduce. And so far, you're seeing the round of layoffs happen. You're seeing people get laid off left, right, and center. But one of the MOs that you're seeing is the tech companies that are laying people off have literally publicly stated that they are refocusing on AI. Google has said this.
What are they laying off?
They're laying off all divisions that are outside of what they price. So they're kind of like restructuring their priorities almost. Google has said they're refocusing on AI. Why? Because Microsoft recently just, you know, massive, massive exclusive partnership with OpenAI. They expanded that. And that means because Microsoft has a cloud, Azure is their cloud. Google has a cloud. It's Google BigQuery. It's also Google Cloud Products. They don't have OpenAI. They have to refocus to be competitive. They have to be able to create something like that.
What happened to DeepMind then?
Their model.
How did DeepMind fall behind?
They have to keep up with the competition, right? And that's ultimately what that looks like. And that's why you're seeing these layoffs happen in essence of cost consolidation and cost reduction. You have to realize that when they're restructuring, it's all due to market competition. It's all due to, I have to compete because I have a cloud product. And if Microsoft's doing this, well, I need to refocus and I need to get resources. And it's a race. It's who can get to utilize the most from the cloud efficiencies to the AI ML applications and who can get there the best, because they all have enterprise contracts. They're all working with some of the largest companies in the world right now, because that's how these business processes work. And if Microsoft is going to take a whole massive market share because of the advantage of OpenAI, Google can't have that, because that means their contract's at threat, right? Their contract's basically going to be at stake because Microsoft could just take the lion's share of business. So it is interesting, because in the same time that all of this is happening, you have massive concern around people who don't have these skill sets, who haven't been exposed to coding, who haven't been in the tech realm, who may, you know, and this leaves that, remember, ethic question, right? Of being able to understand, well, how do we keep a whole bunch of people relevant in this current day and age with the skill sets needed in order to survive? And this is the big conversation that I think is going to happen within the next 2 years. And you're either going to need to look at a UBI solution, because there's just way too many people right now, I could tell you for a fact, that are going to be displaced, leaving at least 5 to 10% of the population worse off than they were. But at every displacement, after the pain has gone, you're always going to have new opportunities, new roles, you know, because the new applications open up these roles, right? Just like how software as a service opened up all the digital media roles, opened up all of these tech roles that didn't exist 20 years ago. This is going to happen again. And we are seeing it happen as we speak right now with the scalability, commercialization, people digging further and further into AI, the quantum research into quantum computing. Like, this is all happening right now. Within the next 2 to 5 years, I'd say, we're going to see some very interesting changes. And we're going to see an exact reflection back from this two paradigm shifts that we endured.
Well, let's be optimistic. I want to be optimistic.
Yeah.
I've been in Ukraine and just learning all the survival and bushcraft stuff, just going through various bad scenarios. But I want to try and be optimistic about our lives becoming more interesting, having more time to do what we want versus just work. And a lot of people just hate their jobs, just absolutely hate it. And they would love to be able to sit back in UBI. But then again, when I look at human nature and look at the whole colonizations of the third world and just like,
right,
you know, it's I don't know if we have what it takes to implement a fair UBI and not for some governments to misuse it. You know?
Yeah. No, I 100% agree. And I think the biggest takeaway that I'll leave here on a good note for everyone listening is to say that this is the prime time of opportunity, meaning that right now, as the paradigm shift's happening, the optimistic outlook is we are in the midst of the paradigm shift due to all of the bad things, the inflation cost, the cost of living, the fact that you should not even look at the housing market right now due to how high the interest rates are. Like, all this stuff that's compounding should be the actual indicator for everyone to look at, okay, well, if all this is happening, that means I'm not the only one in this boat. That means hundreds of thousands of other people, or even millions of other people, are in some similar situation. How can I ramify this and remedy this by being, what can I do right now to be able to learn these skill sets? And the good thing is, information has never been more accessible. Like, you go on YouTube, there's a 12-hour course on Python. You look up anything that you want. There's free resources everywhere currently existing from people, content creators, that recognize this problem with the goal of hoping to fill that skill gap, right? But here's the thing, and it goes back to your point. It depends on the person. Humans have to be proactive in essence of knowing that this is what they want for them to do it. You cannot give this one size fits all. Everyone should learn coding. Everyone should do Python, because we're not as black and white, right? It's not as simple as that. Humans are very complex creatures. And this is really where I think the bulk of everything needs to be. This is the time to find, okay, I got my information. Maybe I've listened to a lot of Nikos's podcasts, or I've listened to some other podcasts, or I've gained some insights here and there. Now, what can I do with that? And this is the opportunity of where you can start to think of getting ahead of the curve before the curve folds.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's been a really fascinating time, Kevin. And I just want to add to that, many people talk about this whole carbon offset, carbon neutral. And I think as we yield this power, we should, as human beings, think, is what I'm doing with this AI going to feed, enclose, and shelter more human beings or less? And based on that decision, we go ahead with that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you're seeing initiatives right now, like OpenAI has a whole entire mission statement saying we do AI for good, right? AI for, and this is how Google started, right? Google started off saying, do no evil. We do everything for good. And that's why I'm saying history often doesn't repeat exactly, but it does often rhyme. And we are seeing almost the same type of effect when the internet was first introduced, because we are introducing a new concept. It's almost like internet number two, where AI ML can exist both as an automation and application. It's only when AI and ML starts to displace full-on core necessities that people should be concerned. And a good example of this is, let's say, you have Elon Musk talking about robotics. You have the robotics industry, such as, Boston, for example. Boston Dynamics, they're ultimately have transcended, right? You're seeing all this stuff. When you merge the robotics and you merge the AI, you can obviously start to do some interesting things that reduce physical manual labor and a whole bunch of other stuff. Sure. But the other way of going about this is, in my opinion, to have a nice balance. If there's some sort of regulation or some sort of rules that says that the machine isn't going to full on replace the livelihood of the human, but rather help the human. Almost like how right now we're using cranes, we're using all these construction equipment. What if these robots were able to lift much heavier and do all this stuff, right? But they're able to help the actual person that does that job from injuring themselves. That's one way of being able to use robotics and AIs as an application, not a replication. Mm-hmm. The other way is, why don't we have them support the actual workforce? This way, the company may need to hire less, but they're not hurting any livelihoods in the process, because this goes back into our cost estimate, right? But then all of this depends on the actual regulatory states, the current state of the union for how people want to go about things, and then you have the ethics of things as well.
So that's very optimistic. And the only thing, another thing comes to mind, though, is that I think a lot of our conversation has been based around the Western mindset, the Western ideals, Western morality, whatever you want. But we haven't thought about really yet what happens if, I won't use names here, certain countries without our ethics. They're not thinking about UBI, and they're not thinking about world peace. They're probably looking at how do we use AI and not just like, you know, hackers or stuff like that, but AI as warfare. I'm sure 100% there must be people 100%. With warfare AI that would basically connect to the internet and do a lot of damage. We don't. That'd be a good novel, man, if someone wants to write about that.
I mean, well, again, to your point, like I said, history often doesn't repeat, but it rhymes because the internet was built by, it was DARPANET. It was by military. It was pretty much all specific to, you know, computers, and all this was military first. It was supposed to be in this jurisdiction of where it was used for special forces, it was used for tactical operations. It only then became commercialized and introduced for both consumer use and business use, right? And we're seeing the same exact thing with AI and ML. I am 100% sure there's going to be military use. There's going to be tactical government use, but there's obviously going to be commercialization as well, and also consumer use. I'm sure schools are finding ways, and they're already talking about finding ways of being able to use AI to help teach students. I think when it passed the bar exam, pretty much the law school said that although ChatGPT would make a mediocre law student, it still passed the exam. And professors are starting to think about how to use ChatGPT and other AI sources to better challenge their students, to be able to make them better lawyers. So they're starting to think about this already. They're already starting to think about ways of AI application and ways of how to use AI as a way to enhance and reinforce the actual humans that are attending the classes.
Mm-hmm. Just going back quickly to the replication of the voice, it puts a different light on what actually is evidence in a court if you can replicate all these things. And the only way you can mitigate that is to have all these crazy sensors owned by the government around to actually verify things that happen. And that just opens up a whole Pandora's box. So in a
sense,
it has already destroyed a lot of evidence, you know, because every lawyer now in court case jury is going to have to take into consideration, is this, you know, it could be your defense. This is not my voice. This is AI. Right. That's already a defense. So
this is where we get into the topic of, and you've seen this, you've heard this. I mean, banks have said this. Blockchain application is another proof of use for who owns what, as well as where it came from. A lot of people, they confuse blockchain with cryptocurrencies. And there is a big misconception there in the sense that, you know, blockchain is a very useful application. And Jamie Dimon has went on public record and has talked about this, how they use it. It's very useful for them to basically have that proof of work and proof of service and also transmit. But if you utilize blockchain and let's say have this AI generated voice, and then you will be able to actually verify who it was and if it was you, right? Because it's coming from a specific source. But now you're introducing, like you said, a Pandora's box and a can of worms that hasn't been opened, which is where are all of our wallets, meaning our bank accounts and all this stuff, and our humans, even our social security cards and all this stuff, is it going to be tethered by blockchain? Because in order for this to happen, in order for you to have, okay, I didn't record this voice note, your tool, your phone and all this stuff would have to have some sort of blockchain ID. It has to have some sort of signature that's able to verify that. Otherwise, what is it connected to that's able to show where it's coming from, right? And this introduces a whole new can of worms that we haven't even opened.
Okay, well, with that, Kevin, thanks so much for your insights. I really appreciate it. You've delivered way above my expectations, and they were even high. So until next time, thanks very much, and thanks everybody. Absolutely. For watching.
Yep, thank you, Nikos.